Dear Dhammar friends, I like to draw your attention on the next item on this mindfulness for young adults session. So we are discussing Sabbasava Sutta, which is available in Majjhima Nikaya, because it is giving us a lot of insights in our practice. So there are actually, Buddha talks about seven methods how to overcome our defilements in a way, how to overcome various fetters, internal tendencies. Now these all seven methods are very practical and there is no any sort of chronological order or there is any kind of ascending order here. Rather, it is very practical order. You can apply any of these techniques at any given time what is appropriate. Say for example, if you are in a color lights, so you have no option, you simply have to wait. So rather than becoming agitated, rather than become impatient, you can be patient. So the patience has to be practiced. Again, if you know that there is a bad place that has to be avoided, certain people that have to be avoided, so there you can practice this parivajjana pahatabba, the abandoned by avoiding. So that can be applied. So as like that, so depending on the situation, you can apply any of these techniques, whatever is appropriate. So especially when we are meditating, so definitely the last one is continuously applied. Various good qualities are being developed. And while meditating even, we have to be patient. And we have to maintain some seclusion, we have to avoid certain things. And again, we have to restrain ourselves. So sometimes it is not just one method. Even couple of methods are working hand in hand, are working and helping each other. So likewise, these all seven methods are very practical and we can apply them depending on the situation. And last time we discussed actually abandoned by avoiding. Now we can discuss the other one, that is taints that should be abandoned by removing. Now, what is there to remove? So, there are various hindrances, various mental qualities which are in a way harmful to the mind and it is generating some sort of a negativity in the mind. So, these negative mental states, if we can maintain at a distance, keep them at bay, so then we can fairly protect our mind. So the term Nivarana itself has that meaning, that it is sort of blocking the opening of the mind, blocking the freedom, covers the freedom. So our mind is very much like a kind of a covered thing. So the internal beauty, internal bliss or internal clarity is fairly blocked, fairly covered because of this outer sheath. But fortunately this outer sheath is not that thick. So Buddha fairly give a promising answer there, telling that the inner level of the mind, inner nature of the mind is naturally clean, naturally in a way pure. Pabassara midam bhikkave citta tanchako agantukehi upakkilesehi upakkilittam. So that is what Buddha is telling. Monks, this the very inherent nature of the mind is fairly pure, very clear. But unfortunately, the intruding defilements, the outside defilements coming from due to various reasons, are in a way temporary polluting the mind, temporary obstructing the mind. So if one believes him, so then we can have a sort of a faith, sort of a confidence. Why can't we remove that outer sheath? Why can't we at least penetrate to this inner pure nature? So that is where he is in a way sort of motivating, that telling that this inner nature is originally pure, originally clean. So that is the sort of our original nature. So we all have that nature. It is not just limited to one group of people, one nationality like that. But every human being have this inner beautiful clean nature. But unfortunately, very few believe it. Very few sort of work towards it. Very few try to remove this outer polluted layer and try to be with that beautiful inner nature. We can call it even Buddha nature. We can call it as the Buddha's mind. We can call it as the pure mind. Now, once we recognize that, so then it's a matter of maximizing it. It's a matter of maintaining it as much as possible. Now, it happens at different levels. So at one stage, Buddha says, okay, there are wholesome states, there are unwholesome states. So we have to develop wholesome states and we have to avoid unwholesome states. So that is one part of the virya in a way. So one type of virya effort is to, when there are various defiled thoughts are available in the mind, so we are trying to remove it. So that is what actually we need to discuss today. And on the other hand, if our mind already pure, there are no defilements at all, then we need to protect it. On the other hand, if there are already arisen, say, wholesome states, then we need to protect it. We need to further improve it, make them complete. And if there are no arisen good levels, good thoughts, or rather wholesome states, we have to try hard to improve them. But when we are talking about the Satipatthana, we are going to a fairly mature level where we are recognizing that all wholesome states and the unwholesome states have the nature to come and go, have the nature to arise and pass away. So once we remove all of them, what is remaining? So what is remaining is again wholesome. What is remaining is again fairly pure. So that is the inner nature. So therefore, kind of a beauty is there. So till we develop a fair amount of mindfulness, we have to protect the mind from various defilements. But as we develop mindfulness, even defilements can be used to develop wisdom. So that's the beauty, in a way, the beauty of the Buddha's teaching. So say for example, once we reach the Nivarana Pabba in Satipatthana Sutta, so that is the technique Buddha is talking there. So we don't recognize with Nivaranas, we don't identify with hindrances, rather we recognize them as sort of external conditions, external qualities. They have the nature to come, and if we are not motivating them, if we are not feeding them, they have the nature to go. So we have our sort of safe vantage point. So we are being there, we are watching. So likewise, as we develop mindfulness, so a fair amount of confidence develop in oneself that now I don't need to struggle hard with these various hindrances. Even if they arise, I know how to handle them. But before that, we have to be a little careful of various hindrances, because still the mindfulness is not strong enough. Still, I don't have much confidence. Still, I don't have much confidence about my own practice. Then I have to be a little careful on these various defilements. So Buddha talks here, especially on to the removing aspect in the Sabbasava Sutta. There Buddha says, if there is any sort of a sensual thought, sort of a lustful thought arisen in the mind, don't tolerate it. Don't sort of feed it. Don't enjoy it. Rather try to avoid it. Rather try to allow it to go. So there are many methods we can apply here. Say for example, if you know sort of asubha bhavana, loathsomeness of the body, so there you can apply that method. Or if you know this body consists of various bodily parts, you can little sort of reflect on those bodily parts, and you can even remove those that arisen lust. But on the other hand, if the mindfulness has fairly developed, you don't need to utilize all those cross techniques. Rather, you can face to face be with the lust. There is lust arisen. Now, how about being with it? How about face to face recognizing it? So that is where some maturity of mindfulness developing in ourselves, where we are now not identifying with lustful thoughts, rather we recognize due to various causes they are coming, and you can be aware of them. And once you are aware of them, you are making kind of a distance, kind of a detached observation. As a result, they start to fade away. Now you are not lustful thoughts. They are not your lustful thoughts. They are merely lustful thoughts. So they have their own nature. They have their own agenda. So they are not yours. So there's a kind of a beautiful evolvement happens in our practice. As I said, anyway, at the beginning we don't have that much of a confidence. We don't have that much of clarity in the mind. And we don't have enough mindfulness developed in order to recognize these lustful thoughts at their very early stages. Therefore, if they come, we are in a little bit of a risk. So therefore, maintaining kind of a protective shield is much better at that level. So that's why we are trying to restrain ourselves, not to go to some bad places so that we get sort of polluted. So likewise, we are maintaining some amount of restrainment in order to protect ourselves. Now similarly, Buddha talks here about ill will. So when there is ill will in the mind, so don't try to rationalize yourself, or don't try to justify yourself, thinking that you are correct, the other person is bad, he is wrong. Likewise, if you keep on thinking like that, definitely you are boiling yourself. You start to further improve various defilements. But on the other hand, if you know there is ill will arisen in the mind, now it's a matter of recognizing ill will as ill will. Not that the person generated ill will, but ill will arisen in the mind. So this objective recognition is very important. So it is not that you are burning with ill will, this is my ill will, rather it is ill will. So why am I continuing with ill will? Why do I need to improve it? Is it really necessary to get angry? Assume that someone is doing wrong thing. Say he or she is not sort of behaving as I wish. So you get irritated. So is this irritation really necessary? Do you really need to be angry? Do you really need to scold? So likewise, you can actually question yourself. So all these habits we have, are they really necessary? So this is a kind of a reflection we can do. So we are used to get angry. We are used to get agitated. So this habit, in a way, is something coming from long past, and again we are developing it. We are motivating it. We are fertilizing it. How about stopping it? It may be true that you can't immediately do it, but as you are applying brakes, as you recognize that you are the one going to burn because of this ill will, then you may understand various repercussions of it. And then you can avoid burning from it. You can stop it in the middle, and at least at that level you can allow it to fade away. Because once you start to get detached from it, so it loses its grip. It loses its source of energy. So you are the one actually energizing it. You are the one promoting, feeding it. So once you cut off that resource path, then it is become almost nullified. Then it will slowly fade away. Because it alone can't sustain. It alone can't survive. Unless you provide enough energy. So this actually we have to practically learn. So you can't actually learn these things even while in the sitting practice. Now if you simply say sit cross-legged, close your eyes, now you are trying to recognize ill will. Do you think ill will come to the mind? Very unlikely. Do you think lust come into the mind? Very unlikely, because you are fairly ready. And you may be in a very comfortable position. You are fairly protected. and mind is also quite calmed down. So there is very less possibility to various defilements come at that level. Actually, there are possibilities, of course, but as you are further improving, your mind stay calm. But on the other hand, assume now you are at your office, now you are with your family members, now you are dealing with your neighbors. So at that time, your mind is not that ready. Therefore, there is a possibility of irritation. There's a possibility of anger. There's a possibility of lust. There's a possibility of various other defilements. Because you are now little in a vulnerable situation. You are dealing with many other situations. So the possibility of arising defilements is very high. But that is the very place you need to practice. Don't think that you always have to practice while being at your room, on your cushion. So that is only at the earlier stages. But practice has to be practically applied at all other places. So that is why I mentioned all these different techniques mentioned in the Sabbasava Sutta are very practical methods we have to use then and there. As it is conducive, as it is the opportunity, the right opportunity is there, then we have to apply these various techniques. Now, similarly, Buddha talks about various sort of cruel thoughts in the mind. We call them as vihinsa vitakka. So these different thoughts are there in the mind sometimes. You are wishing that someone get someone's harm, or some little cruel thoughts may happen in the mind. But if you recognize them and simply allow them to go, recognizing them as harmful to yourself, harmful to another person, so you can actually protect your mind. And Buddha summarizes here telling, whatever the arisen unwholesome thoughts, uppannuppanne papake akusale dhamme, nadivaseti pajahati vinodeti byanti karoti anubhavangameti. You are not tolerating them, you are not promoting them, you are not feeding them. Rather, you allow them to go. You allow them to fade away. And once they're gone, so you are now trying to protect that pure mind. You now trying to protect that clean mind, clarity of the mind. Because if we don't recognize that pure mind, that is also in a way we are not really giving marks to the correct side. Say for example, if you are sort of helping your child, your kid. So at that time, if he does something good, you have to appreciate it. If he did something wrong, then probably you can warn him. So likewise, our own mind, so when it is free from any defilement, so we have to appreciate it. We have to recognize it. We have to give some marks. We have to value it. Similarly, if there are sort of defilements, then we have to slowly remove it. So this removal is possible in many different ways. And discussed in many suttas, how to overcome these various defiled thoughts. Say for example, your mind is now lustful. So at that time, as I explained, probably you can think about various bodily parts. This body is not just a unique thing as a one unit. It consists of many different bodily parts. None of them appear beautiful. None of them appear attractive. So likewise, this is one method. On the other hand, you can simply shift your attention from whatever the object to another completely different object. Assume that you are looking at something, watching something. Because of that, lust is now arising. Anger is arising. Whatever defilement is arising. So once you recognize it, so you can simply shift your attention to completely different thing. So that is another technique. Now you are not promoting or feeding this channel. Rather, you are sort of diverting your attention to something else. So that is another thing. So likewise, there are many techniques Buddha describes how to overcome various defilements. One important thing here is that assume that you are thinking more and more of something irritating. Something sort of resentful, something angry, something hateful. Assume that you are doing it for a long time. Now, even if you want to stop it, you can't stop. Because there's a kind of a gravity in the mind, kind of an inclination in the mind develops because of your continuous thinking in that line. So that is something very beautiful Buddha mentions. So there's a kind of a nati. Nati in Pali called kind of an inclination in the mind, depending on what you think. So if you think something bad, so more and more mind shows the bad side. More and more mind shows us the faults, drawbacks. On the other hand, if the mind thinks the positive side, more and more mind will show the positive aspects. Assume that you are thinking more on the ill will. Again and again you are finding fault with another person. So more faults will be available. More reasons to be unhappy. More reasons to be angry. But on the other hand, assume that you are thinking good about another person. How much he helped me, how beautiful he is, how, say, generous he is. Likewise, assume that you are thinking something good. So then the mind will turn in that way. So likewise, what you think will become what you are. So this is in a way explained in the neuroscience as well. It's called neuroplasticity. So in the neuroplasticity, they understood, so what you are thinking can condition your mind. So those habits become fairly engraved to the mind. If you want to correct yourself, then you can apply the same technique. If you understand certain habits, certain habitual thinking is really harmful to you, slowly you have to avoid that way of thinking. Rather, you have to apply some different way of thinking. Another countermeasure has to be applied in order to recover from that bad way of thinking, that wrong trait in our mind. So, protecting our mind is in a way our own responsibility. That actually Buddha can't do it for us. That our parents can't do it. That our husband, wife, children can't do. That our own self, we ourselves have to do. So Buddhas merely show the path, so we ourselves have to protect ourselves. So here also Buddha helping us, guiding us to deal with it, where he says that when various thoughts are there, various wrong habits are there, you need to recognize them and you need to understand why they are there. How about removing it? How harmful they are? How about slowly avoiding those harmful habits and correcting myself? So this whole correction is in a way onto ourselves. So Buddha has shown the path, but we ourselves have to watch our own mind. What are these various defiled states? What are these wrong habits, harmful habits? So how I can overcome them? How I can maintain that pure mind? How can I maintain that simple mind, unattached mind? So you are now encouraging that simple mind. You are now encouraging that undefiled mind, unentangled mind. So without encouraging that, without appreciating that, you can't promote it. So in order to promote something, you have to encourage it. You have to appreciate it. So the same techniques that we can apply to our own self. So in a way, we have to be a little self-compassionate because you can't do it immediately. But if you really compassionate to yourself, then this is what we need to do. So we understand we are not perfect. Another person is also not perfect. So how about recognizing my imperfections, recognizing all these harmful habits and slowly overcome them, forgiving myself, slowly overcome them. And again, giving some appreciation to the goodness in myself, to the possibilities available, to the skills available in a way. So that maintaining that pure mind, unagitated mind, undefiled mind. So likewise, we are in a way in this Sabbasava Sutta, we are more into the psychology. So we are more into this understanding of our own traits, understanding our own habits, and trying to develop more of an unattached mind, which doesn't have this or that, but rather it has the clarity, it has the freedom, it has the unentangled nature, unbound nature. So this is what Buddha appreciates. This is what Buddha say, something useful, something harmless. And he asks us to protect it. He asks us to maintain as much as possible. So with that note, I like to conclude today's short Dhamma sermon. Now I like to open the session for questions.
I'm sorry, Bhante, there can't be five questions. Question number one, the general question. Dear Bhante, last time there was clarification on the reasons for opting for Western experiments to showcase mindfulness and related measurements. As Bhante explained, it can be encouragement to someone new to the practice. However, my viewpoint is that we are trying to showcase something which is not relevant and not possible with these types of science experiments. It seems somewhat like measuring the temperature, radiation, vibration, and other aspects outside a central processing unit or CPU of a computer. We can get some measurements and graphs and explain what happens when it is working, which can be completely not related and fail to explain the internal workings of the CPU. Similarly, the workings and quality of the mind. The Western experiments are fundamentally based on the capability to gather data and the ability for anyone to test and recreate the experiments for verification. My understanding is that mindfulness practice we do, data is completely internal, not the brain waves, anyone who wants to do the experiment needs to follow a certain method or practice over a time period and generate his or her data set for verification and understanding. This data is unique to the individual and cannot be transferred to outside or anyone else. If this is the case, then the science-based experiments cannot be applied to such scenarios and we might be measuring something completely not relevant. With all respect, I thought of writing this down and I remain at your disposal. With metta, that's the end.
I agree with you. So basically, that's why, even on that day, I mentioned you can't completely say they are 100% correct. And you can actually refer many research papers. And one pioneer in this area is Dr. Richard Davidson. And he's the one actually used many Tibetan lamas in this sort of experiments at its very early stages. And now there are many are doing such experiments. That's how they are coming up with various instruments to measure all these different brain waves. And it gives some kind of approximate measurement of how our brain works. And on the other hand, this, as you said, it is very difficult. It's very difficult to measure how the mind is pure in a way, because it's a very complex situation, and how the brain works and how it actually sort of correlates with the mind is a very difficult scenario that we can analyze. And there are many exceptions also available. Actually, I can remember one scientist was saying that someone who has only gray matter in the brain, and even he is having enough memory and all the functions, he also performs. There is no any typical type of, as a normal person, he doesn't have all the other components, but mostly it's the gray matter he's talking. But still this person is going to office and operates like a normal person. So likewise, there are many exceptional cases also available, which actually can't justify by the scientific findings. But anyway, as you said, we don't need much of this scientific evidence for us to follow the path. Rather, we have our own faith in a way. Now, this is not a practice that we are sort of reinventing. Rather, this is a very ancient practice. So all these very beautiful techniques, all these very deep, beautiful techniques, Buddha has mentioned about 2600 years ago. And it has been practiced by many thousands, millions of people. And they have their own concrete results. and they have lived an exemplary life, and we getting motivated because of their good lives, their examples. So this is what we are faithfully following. And not only that, as we follow it, as we practice it, we ourselves can verify it. So we become an example. It is not that always that we have to follow others, we ourselves become sort of examples to ourselves. Because we ourselves can verify it. It is not something that based on the blind faith. Rather, we, as we continue our practice, slowly we can verify what is really happening within myself. It's a kind of a behavioral change has to happen within myself. The way I think, the way I give values, so the way I handle situations, the way I get decisions, and how the mind reacts, how clean the mind is. So likewise, these are very concrete answers we ourselves can have. So we ourselves become the sort of an experiment. We are doing a sort of an experiment. So that is why Buddha talks like a Arya Pariyesana. It's a noble conquest. It's a noble experiment. It is not that we are doing with outsiders, but rather we do this experiment using our own self. So we are observing our mind, we are observing our behavior, and if these techniques are really working, so we ourselves have to feel it. That's why Buddha, starting with Satipatthana, he's talking ekaino ayam bhikkave maggu sattanam visuddhiya soka pariddavanam samatikkamaya dukkha domanassanam attagamaya nyayassa adigamaya nibbanassa satchikriyaya. So these are the promising results that he's talking. Now as we practice, at least to some extent, we should feel them. Otherwise, we have gone somewhere wrong. So if we really feel them, if we can really sort of agree with these promising results, then definitely we ourselves become a kind of a living example to the Buddha's teaching. So I therefore agree with your statement. So you can't completely give a complete picture using the scientific findings, but we'll anyway, people are believing in science, so that's why at least using them we can motivate at least some few people who are so materialistic. They believe on physics, they believe on science, which is in a way fairly childish when compared with the Buddha's teaching.
Question number 2 of 6. This is walking mindfulness. Dear Venerable Sir, with your guidance, I managed to practice sitting and walking mindfulness for some time now. A lot of merits for your valuable instructions and to this program for facilitating the practice. When I was doing the last walking session, I tried to observe how mindfulness builds up and how to distinguish it with concentration. My understanding is, the moment I become aware of the body or any process in the body, I become mindful. It seems like the awareness which spreads across the present moment activities is mindfulness, and this facilitates the knowing. It can spread across to cover anything and encompass anything. Once this awareness or mindfulness is established, it is possible to focus on one object. This focus will gather awareness to this object more and more, and this can be understood as concentration. Is it possible to release the focus and be with the total awareness and come back to the focus object again? Therefore, as I understood, the present moment awareness or mindfulness should be established first in order to develop concentration. Is this correct, Venerable Sir? Much thanks for your explanation. That's the end.
Actually, I mean, both are possible. Because one can develop concentration first and then try to expand it. That is also possible. And first one can develop some amount of expanded mindfulness and then one can focus attention. That is also possible. So both ways are available. So that is why in a way samatha vipassana, vipassana samatha. Both approaches are possible. As I said, now suppose in practical example, if we talk, say you are being aware of various sounds happening at this very moment. So you have a kind of a pervasive kind of mindfulness. So you can include many things. Later, once you establish mindfulness with that, Now you can focus your attention to breath. Now you are very much focused. So that approach is possible. Assume that you are starting with the breath. So you start with breath. So you are very focused on the breath. Breath becomes subtle. And now you have a fair amount of concentration. Later, you can open up your attention to various sounds available in the outside or various sensations available throughout the body. Now you are again expanding your attention. So you started with concentration, now you are anyway expanding your awareness. So that is also possible. So both approaches are possible. So depending on the person, I mean some people like first to develop some concentration, some focus attention, and then later naturally allow it to expand. But on the other hand, some others, they like to simply be aware of various sounds, be connected with the nature first, calm down, relax, and then focus attention to something small. So both approaches are there.
Question number 307. Theory question. Dear Bhante, I came across the Heart Sutta recently and found it contains some deep concepts of emptiness and related philosophy. Just for our understanding, what is the main demarcation between Mahayana and our Tipitaka? I recall when we were in Sri Lanka, we used to run away even from a Mahayana glimpse. Is it so different and bad with metta? That's the end.
I have very less understanding about Mahayana suttas, so I don't have a complete answer on this. So my answer will be more biased towards Theravada. So therefore, I don't like to give a concrete answer here. So the difference I feel is in the Theravada, traditional Theravada practice has somewhat given prominence to the canon, the Pali Tripitaka, and that actually Mahayana Buddhists also believe, and actually they also accept as the sort of the source. Say for example, especially the Sutta Pitaka. And they also have the Sutta Pitaka. Say for example, if you consider Vajrayana and Mahayana, they have their, say for example, in the Pali Tripitaka, we have the Digha Nikaya. So in the Vajrayana and Mahayana, they have the Dirga Agama. Similarly, we have Majjhima Nikaya, they have Majjhima Agama. So likewise, these Agama Ganthas are quite parallel. Actually, Venerable Analeo, Bhikkhu Analeo, German Bhikkhu Analeo has done a very comprehensive study of this analysis, comparison, Majjhima Agama and Dirga Agama. Sorry, Majjhima Agama and Majjhima Nikaya, Dirga Agama and Dirga Nikaya. So likewise, he has done a very comprehensive analysis on comparison between these canon, Mahayana canon and the Theravada canon. So he found many similarities. So therefore we can say safely, so the core teaching of the Buddha is still untouched or not harmed. It is quite common to all the Mahayana and the Theravada. But on the other hand, there are many customs unique to Mahayana and there are many customs unique to Theravada. So this appear like the outer shield. So from the outer appearance, they are quite different. But once you go deeper and to the core teaching level, so it is the Buddha's teaching. So therefore, we can safely say both are true to the core level. But again, we can say there are many differences in the outside appearance. Because as you know, whenever a religion is practiced by a certain group of people, as it is going on and on for a time, so there are many cultural additions coming in, there are many customs adding in, many rituals adding in. So once we see from outside, then you can't immediately recognize the internal, core of the teaching. Rather, what you see is the outside rituals. So it happens to any religion. So therefore, so you decide, okay, this is wrong, this is correct, this is bad, this is wrong. So likewise, many evaluations are there. But if you go more deeper to the core teachings, it's maybe quite similar.
Question number 407, Mindful Sitting. Dear Bhante, appreciate if you can explain a bit more about the vantage point highlighted in today's guided sitting. Is it the subtle breath where mindfulness is established, or is it the blank space where the breath has disappeared altogether? At what time should we call the mindfulness object a vantage point to observe thoughts? That's the end of the question.
Yeah, actually, at the beginning, you can't recognize it. So because you are very closely observing the object. So you don't have such vantage point at the beginning. You are closely observing this present phenomena. Maybe breath. So you are closely examining it. It's whether it is raw, cool, whether it is warm, whether it is short, whether it is long. So it's a kind of, you are closely associating with it. But later as you practice, you are recognizing some kind of a vantage point where you are not the object. And you are not something else either. And you have kind of a safe awareness. So this awareness becomes kind of a vantage point. So it's kind of an island, you can say. So you are unattached, awareness is available. So you can step back from the ongoing process and be in that vantage point and can watch it. So sometimes teachers used to say, you are in a kind of an island. And there are many waves happening in the ocean. There are many boats, ships going in the ocean. You are in the island and you can watch them. Likewise, so assume that there are many waves happening in the mind. Maybe lustful waves, ill will thoughts, so many things are there. But you have the safe place, you can simply watch them. They are not yours. So likewise, you get sort of a confidence on your own practice, your own safe place. So you have we have the unattached nature to be in a way. So this is what I like to mention. I wanted to mention there. So the mindfulness practice slowly helps us to recognize it. So it is not that immediately available. Rather, as we develop mindfulness, so slowly we are detached from the ongoing process. So this detachment naturally happens. So then kind of a distant observation happens. So the process is one thing, observation is another thing, and there's a kind of a distance between these two. So you can do this detached observation. So where are you established? So there is no any place. You can't say I'm at a particular place and observing it. You can of course say, okay, while being in the breath, I am watching a thought. That you can say. Or while being in a thought, I am watching a breath. So that's also you can say. But anyway, at that level, you become now, say, when you are being in the breath, assume that is your mula kamatahana, primary object. And now you can watch a thought. So that is, in a way, some level of vantage point you can say. But that is also evolving. You don't need continuously attached to a primary object in order to do that. Later, you don't need to associate even a primary object. So likewise, kind of an evolvement happens in the mind. So you become fairly independent. Mind become fairly independent.
Question number 507. This is the question. First, Venerable Bande, it's about the pure mind you discussed. Is this the Prabhashrava Manasa that a baby is born with? Most grateful for your clarification. That's the end.
Yeah, you can say so, but as again we need to add there, so don't think that the baby is an arahant. So temporarily, baby's mind is fairly pure. So that is why Buddha mentioned there are different levels of defilements he talks about. So the undefiled mind, we can say, is Prabhasara, fairly clean. But yet, there are certain tendencies available. So till we are able to recognize these tendencies, these asavas, these fetters, then still we have the potential to get corrupted, potential to again sort of get defiled. On the other hand, if one is able to recognize all these traits, all these asavas available in the mind and slowly remove it, then we can say, okay, we are safe in a way. Now, just to give an example, kind of an analogy, assume there is a water bottle and there are some mud in it. And if you keep it for a long time, so it become sedimented. Now you can see very clean water. So this is where we can say the Pabassara mind. Okay, the visible part is fairly clean. But unfortunately, still some sedimented defilements are there. That sedimentation is there. Assume that one is able to even remove that. Then you can safely say it is completely Pabassara, completely pure, and it is the Asavakkhaya. So that is the Arahant's mind, where even the potential to become defiled is not there. Even that hidden tendencies are gone, removed, so that there is no possibility of getting defiled. Even if you sort of shake a pure water bottle, if there are no mud, no sedimentation, so even more you hard shake it, it don't become sort of muddy, because there is no mud in it. So similarly, there is something beautiful that we can think of. Temporarily, actually, once the defilements are, or the hindrances are away, subsided, one can experience this some pure mind, but it doesn't guarantee that it will last forever. Once you see something, again mind can get defiled. Once you hear something, again mind can get defiled. So that is the sort of risk there. So that's why we need a fair amount of practice. That's why we need to again and again watch our mind. So why, how this mind get further defiled? And we need to recognize those defilements. We need to recognize those harmful habits and slowly remove them. So,
question number 6 of 7. This is a general question. Dear Bhante, I have been feeling stressed recently. Last night I had a bad nightmare. Usually when this happens, I think of the Itibisu chanting, but it was very hard to settle down. I also noticed the tightness in my chest the past few days. Sometimes it feels like I am having a panic attack. What is an effective way to manage these feelings when they arise? With metta, that's the end.
So basically, I think we are the ones giving more emphasis to these feelings, these emotions. So once we give more value to them, once you keep on thinking, on and on it, then it becomes kind of a devil. It becomes really difficult to bear. It becomes sort of an obsession. So if we are able to handle it at the very early stages, then that is the safe level. So that is why, so more we have to maintain some amount of morality. Otherwise, if we have less morality, then again mind become defiled. Mind starts to lose its confidence. And you lose feeling that you are a worthy person. Then it's difficult to maintain a kind of a pure mind. And on the other hand, when you have such kind of a confidence, okay, I didn't do something wrong, he might have misunderstood me. So then you have your own confidence, that because you have maintained proper sila, proper morality, so you have that confidence, you get that refuge from yourself. You get that certainty from yourself. So therefore, others can tell anything, but I know that I am correct. It is not kind of a biased sort of a decision, rather you have maintained proper sila. So therefore, honestly, you can say, okay, he have misunderstood, she has misunderstood, something went wrong, but I have protected sila. So that becomes your refuge. And on the other hand, while having that, assume still mind talks about this and that. So at that time, we need to recognize those thinking as early as possible. And if you know that, if you keep on thinking on and on, it will be a sort of a harmful to the mind, and it will be really stressful. So then try to avoid that thinking. So in order to stop that wrong thinking, you can apply many methods. So as we discussed today, maybe if it is something ill will going on, then you can apply maybe metta. If it is ill will, you can directly be with it. You can simply understand it. If enough mindfulness is available, you can simply deal with it, so that you have the confidence. So likewise, many methods are there. So I feel, these things are actually happen time to time to everyone. Don't think that I am away from all these, though I am explaining this to you. It can happen to me as well. But when it is free, when we are free from it, we can recognize this harmless mind. We can recognize this pure mind, sort of simple mind, unattached mind, and try to be with that for a long time. Then fairly our mind is sort of strengthened, and even if temporarily it shifts, we can come back to that previous state fairly quickly. So that is what Buddha talks in the Indriya Bhavana Sutta, how quickly we can return to that clarity of mind, how quickly we can return to that equanimous mind. So these are all, in a way, lessons. So everyone actually goes through various hardships, ups and downs in their life. So once we overcome them, so we have some sort of a strength that we have gone through these difficulties, I somehow was able to overcome that. So we have such a mental strength. So these are the ones actually strengthening our mindfulness muscle, we can say.
Question number 7 of 8 is a general question. Dear Venerable Sir, during the sitting and then listening to the Dhamma talk, I felt an icy pressure starting at the bottom inside of the spine and moving upwards, and then it stopped halfway. I think I mentioned this last week during Venerable Bhante's Dhamma talk as well. Sorry for asking again. Is there anything I should do? It's not trouble at all. It's just very prominent. Much merits and with metta. That's the end of the question.
No, I think we don't need to particularly do anything because they come and go and we have almost no control on them and we don't know what will be the next kind of a feeling. So this is what the lesson that they are trying to tell us. So if we have a sort of an open mind to learn from them, then we are able to learn some teaching from them. So they are not happening according to my wish. They behave according to their own agenda. They behave there according to own causes and conditions. So I am experiencing them. So you can even remove the I part. So there's an experience going on. And there are many waves happen. And Buddha gives a very beautiful simile. And he says, if you consider the sky, so there are different types of winds. There may be sand winds. There may be sort of storms. There may be circular winds. Many different kinds of winds are there in the sky. They come and go. They have the nature to come and go. Due to various reasons, they arise. And after that, they fade away. So similarly, our mind, our body also go through various states, various situations. They have the nature to come and go. So without being really bothered by them, so we can observe them as a third person. So that is what Buddha talks about, parato, looking at things like a third person, not belongs to me, looking at it like an outsider. So more we have this detached observation, more properly, carefully, easily we can handle them.
Question number 8. This is a general question. I don't think it is correct to say that these practices were developed by the Buddha. These were developed by thinkers, philosophers, and seekers way before the Buddha described them. Those techniques were used to calm the mind, develop the mind, concentrate the mind, and to become free of conflict and to find peace. I think Buddha described these as worldly mindfulness techniques and explained that these techniques increased vanity and reinforced the basic problem of self and self-purification. With metta, that's the end.
Yeah, actually some methods were already there. So that's why, we all went through Buddha's character, Buddha to be as a Bodhisattva. So while in search of the techniques while in search of the Buddhahood. So he even has gone to different teachers. So they actually taught him different concentration techniques. So, say for example, Alara Kalama Putta, Uddhakarama Putta. So they all have some amount of concentration practices. But on the other hand, something unique is available with the Buddha. So that is more into the Vipassana practice. That is more into the Satipatthana practice. So he come up with certain proper path. So if one develops such a path, then complete purification is possible. And again, he recognized that it is simply by concentrating the mind, you can't overcome all defilements. You can simply subside defilements. So the previous teachers actually thought that they can maintain a concentrated mind and that is fairly pure. And so they thought this concentration practice is the goal. But Buddha didn't agree with that. So rather Buddha actually utilized concentration practice, but he doesn't consider it as the goal. While having a concentrated mind, he asked to recognize various phenomena, to recognize their behavior, to understand their true nature. So that is more unique to the Buddha's teaching. We are understanding the nature of everything. It is not by a book or not by using an instrument, rather using your own mind. So you have a fairly calm, quiet, focused mind, concentrated mind, and using which again and again you are observing various phenomena. You are observing your own body. You are observing various feelings, observing the mental states, and you can apply that same sort of understanding even to the outside. So it is not limited to your own body or limited to your own mind, but even you can expand it to external things as well. So likewise, so there are actually unique things to the Buddha's findings, unique thing to the Buddha's teaching, as well as something common he's sharing with other teachings as well.
Vante, that's the end of the questions.
Sadhu, sadhu.
Do we have time for one more?
Okay, is it from you?
Yes.
Okay.
It's yesterday I met someone, and this person, he was a newcomer to our, we do a little meditation program at the temple. No teachers, it's just come and walk in, sit and then go.
Yeah.
And he had done Goenka, so he had never done walking. So I gave him small instruction and he did the walking and sitting, and he really liked the walking. Afterwards, he asked me, what's the difference between, like, Goenka and, like, our method of Vipassana? And I tried to give a good answer, but I don't really know much about Goenka. What are your thoughts, Bande? Do you know much about Goenka?
As we do, we are trying to get the benefit from all the 4 satipatthanas, not limiting to 1 satipatthana. So the Goenka method give more emphasis onto the 2nd satipatthana, that is the Vedana Anupassana. But anyway, I heard that they have the advanced course where they are touching all 4 satipatthana. Actually, I also have gone through Goenka practice only at the, say, 10-day level, 10 days courses. So there only they talks about the Vedana Anupassana side. Recognizing various sensations available in the body, and that is the primary focus. But when we are going through the proper Satipatthana practice, so we can start with Kayanupassana and fair amount of mindfulness, and wisdom can be developed using that. Then gradually it may move towards the Vedanupassana. That then we can, even if you like, you can practice that. And again, now you can watch your mind, recognize various mental states, various thoughts. You can get the understanding from that, and you can recognize various hindrances, can recognize even enlightenment factors. So it's a very broad spectrum is available in the Satipatthana practice. So that is what we are trying to do, because Buddha talks about all the 4 Satipatthanas. Each one is very rich actually, and if one have very good understanding of all these 4, then actually we can utilize any of them. Each one is very powerful, and depending on our character, more we use any of these techniques, so you can get some more and more benefits. Because we can't generalize saying that to everyone, say there are 1,000 people, to all these 1,000 people, okay, you do only Vedananupassana. We can't generalize like that. So rather we can say, okay, you come and see. You come and practice, start with, say, be Anapanasati. Start with walking meditation. Start with something easy, rising and falling. So we are giving a very easy access to the meditation. And then slowly, he starts to explore his own path. He starts to explore his own method. Definitely, starting with the body is easier. And probably he may shift to Vedananupassana. Probably another may shift to Chittanupassana. Probably another may shift to Dhammanupassana. So likewise, so giving a kind of an open sheet will be much appropriate, I feel, rather than sort of giving a restricted area, only you do this, only be there. So rather than narrowing down the practice, so once we have all four satipatthanas available, so you can get much benefit.
So for our question, So I sort of gave a similar sort of answer. I said, as I understood, it's contemplation of feelings, that's their focus. But then he was also talking about body scanning, and that's what they're doing. And I was thinking about it later, if they're doing body scanning, isn't that contemplation of body?
Yeah, we can say it's a contemplation of the, it is not the contemplation of the body, rather they do go up and down from the top to the bottom and try to recognize various sensations. Now, it is a little bit of conditioning is there, because you are conditioning the mind to, or the force in the mind to recognize various sensations available. But on the other hand, in the Mahasi method, there are less conditioning in a way. Say, for example, when there is a sensation at any place in the body, you can be there and you can actually keep your attention there and you can recognize it. You are not forcing to a particular place even when there is no sensation. Rather, when there is a sensation, as it is appearing, you are there, you are recognizing it. Assume now it appears at a completely different place. So you are now able to keep your attention there and you recognize it. So likewise, some flexibility is there, less conditioning is there in the Mahasi tradition. But anyway, we can't deny Ruan Kal method. So don't think it is wrong method. So it is also very useful technique. And I found many who practice Ruan Kal method can easily adjust to this method, what we are trying to do. So mostly we are trying to do to the all four satipatthanas, and they can easily switch there. So any of these methods, if you practice, so it has much benefits. So therefore, I can't say it is a wrong method. It is a fairly powerful method. And once you have some experience with that, it's a matter of further expanding it into the other satipatthanas.
Thank you, Bhante. That's the end of the questions for today. We'd just like to wrap up. So we'd like to first thank Bhante and pass our merits to Bhante for running this program and giving up valuable time to help ensure it runs, as well as all the organizers and people behind the scenes helping this program, and also those seen and unseen participating and helping out. And most of all, to all the participants, because without you, this program would not go ahead. So with that, I'd like to end the program. Teruvan Saranai.
Teruvan Saranai. Teruvan Saranai.